What's your name?
I
Jay? You're batting 1,000, Jay. My name's Earl. I'm an alcoholic. Actually, you know, I shouldn't have said anything. I should have just got up here, said my name was Neil, and just told, just made up a whole story for Neil. God. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to share up here this weekend. It's always an honor and a privilege. Also, like to thank Bob H. for calling me periodically and keeping an eye on me and making sure that I was going to show up and do what I said I'd do. At this particular point in my life, that's a really good idea. Keep a close eye on me. You never know what's going to happen next. But we'll get into that later. Is this thing really loud? It's fine? How about now? It's really bright up here. Man. So, I'm an alcoholic. And I drank alcohol. I drank it alcoholically. I started drinking it alcoholically when I was 12, which is a very late start by a lot of people's standard. In my neck of the woods, they're coming in at 12. Bless you, whoever did that. I started drinking when I was 12 years old. And the reason I started drinking was because somebody said, would you like a drink? It was not a big deal, you know what I mean? Somebody said, my father shipped me off to boarding school. I was 12 years old. I was 5 feet tall, 104 pounds. I had absolutely no tools for living. But who needs tools for living at 12? You know what I mean? It's like you walk to school, you got mom, dad, sister, dog. You walk up to school, they ask you a few questions, you answer them, you go home. And that was my whole world. They said, it's time to eat, you ate. They said, it's time to go to bed, you went to bed. You know what I mean? Tie your shoes, all right. You know, that was it. I mean, I had no tools for living, but I didn't need any. All of a sudden, my father decided it was time for me to become a man, which was ludicrous. And I can say that now. And they did a bunch of tests on me. I mean, I had been sleepwalking and talking in my sleep. I would get up in the middle of the night and I'd walk through the house and I'd turn the lights on as I'd go through the house. I'd stand at the foot of my parents' bed and talk to them for a while, scare the hell out of both of them. And then I would turn around, I would walk back through the house and turn the lights off as I would go back to the house and get in bed. And they would like follow me. And I would get in bed and they would ask me questions and I would answer them. As told to me by my mother. I have no memory of this at all. And so they took me and they had a battery of psychological tests done on me and an IQ test and all this stuff. It turned out I had a very high IQ. I don't anymore. Part of the price you pay to get here, you know? But I had this high IQ, and they decided. And the way they dealt with the sleepwalking in those days was that they give me a tablespoon of this liquid, and I drink it every night, and it would just knock me out, right? No more problem, right? He's in a coma in the bed. There's no more sleepwalking. And I think that I got the information very early in life that if you don't like the way things are going, take something. That was the message. I filed that away for future reference, and by the time I was 12 and all these tests were done, they decided I needed to go to this boarding school, this think tank. And so we all got in the car one day, and we're just, I'm 12 years old, and they said, get in the car, so I got in the car. We drove and 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 drove, and we pulled up in front of this place, and I got out of the car. Car stopped, I got out. My father got out and he put my suitcase down next to me and he said, this will make a man out of you. And shook my hand, got back in the car, and everybody drove off. A turning point in my life. I mean, the fact was that I was being given an opportunity for a wonderful education. The feeling was that I'd just been thrown away, and I had absolutely no idea what I did to get thrown away. Emotionally, it was absolutely devastating to me. I was paralyzed with fear. And as it turns out, with good reason. This school was 250 young boys from all over the world. It was 9th to 12th grade, and everybody was 13 to 18 years old. I was one of the experimental 8th graders. They were going to have the first 5-year men of this place. There were 16 kids that they'd picked from all over the world, and I was one of them. Lucky me. And all of these 8th graders were 13, and I was 12. I was the only non-teenager on the entire campus. I figured out very quickly, this is a mistake. I don't belong here. I don't fit in. I'm the odd man out. I don't want to play anymore. Where's my mommy? I mean, that was pretty much my view of this whole thing. But there was no getting out of this. I mean, this place was like Lord of the Flies, you know what I mean? It was like 250 of the most disturbed young people they could find, you know, who were all bright enough to really cause a lot of trouble, you know? I'm drinking this caffeine to try to wake up. Very weird combination to be sleepy and frightened at the same time, you know? That's what I am. I'm sleepy and frightened. Oh, it's getting better, though. All right. Caffeine's kind of blasting through the sleepy and wiping out the fear. So I'll be fine in a minute. Oh, man. This is a bad idea. Me standing up here. Anyway, here we go. I'm gone today, Claire. It's really weird. I mean, it's really nice to be here. I mean, San Francisco, I came to here a lot. I'm from like LA, and I blacked out. Oh, I mean, blackouts are like normal for me. And I've come to in this city a lot of times. I went to the college up here, for a while. I'm not sure how long, but those are foggy years, you know. But I love it up here, and I've got the first person who ever extended their hand to me in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is up in this area. He's been out for quite a while now, drinking himself to death, and I was kind of hoping I'd run into him, but I haven't seen him yet. So it means a lot to me in that respect, just because he's up here. And some of my heroes are in the room, too. Some of the other speakers are having to be heroes of mine. And I didn't have any heroes before I got here. You know, now I got a bunch. Anyway, I'm in this school, and I'm walking around trying not to make eye contact with anybody. No tools for living. No idea what's going on, right? And I started to get some tools for living. Life, you don't have them. It's like there's no such thing as a vacuum. You know what I mean? If you're a kid walking around in a whole new place with no tools for living, they will come to you. And I was walking along, and I met Tiny. Every high school's got a guy named Tiny. You know, he's 6'4", 240 pounds. And you know, he found me, you know, and he came up to me and he said, "How you doing, kid?" He slapped me in the back of the head and sent my books flying, and, you know, it was not a good picture. And I had this, like, out-of-body experience, you know what I mean, where you watch yourself doing something that you know is a very bad idea. And it was me. I walked over, and I hit him as hard as I could. And then just stood there, you know, looking up at this guy like, you know, we're already way past anything I know anything about. You know, you're going to have to take it from here, Tiny. And he did. You know, and he said, "You got a lot of guts, kid." And then he beat the crap out of me right on the spot. And I remember as I'm taking this beating, I'm thinking, this is okay. This is going all right. You know, it's all right. Because I knew about taking beatings. I know how to do that, right? But the most important thing to me was that I was absolutely terrified of this guy. And he had just said, "You got a lot of guts." So this violence thing was my first tool for living. If it doesn't matter how terrified you are of everything and everybody, if you're willing to attack people, it will never occur to them that you're a frightened person. You can hide the fear by assaulting people. which I then managed to do regularly for many years, you know? And how violent, I am not a tough guy. I am not a bad guy. I never have been. I never will be. But I got some pretty good war stories that are really the direct result of being frightened, you know? And how violent I became was directly contingent upon how badly you frightened me. You frightened me real bad, I got real violent. It was just the way it was. Luckily, I'm not that big, so I couldn't really hurt anybody. Until I became armed. And that's another story. That'll even it right up a big tiny, won't it? You know? 240, yeah, 45. So word spread across this campus like wildfire. You know, watch out for this little Hightower kid. He's a maniac. He attacked Tiny. You know, so instantly I've got this reputation that has absolutely nothing to do with who I am. Now I got to live up to this, right? Yeah, now I'm a maniac. Okay, great. So all the cool guys started coming around, and Matt came by and he said, "You want to smoke a joint?" And I said, "Well, yeah." I had absolutely no idea what he was talking about. I didn't know what a joint was. But I was alone in the universe, you know what I mean? I needed to hook up. And this guy said, "Do you want to come with us?" The answer was yes. It would have made no difference what that guy said. He could have said, "We're going to go kill a Spanish teacher. Do you want to come?" "I'm with you. Let's go." I wasn't being selective, you know what I mean? I needed to hook up now. So we hooked up, and we took off, and we picked up Steve along the way. And Steve had this container, a Tupperware container, full of cheap red wine. I mean, no grapes involved. You know what I mean? You know, that fortified stuff. You know what I mean? They're really the kind that they used to say, "Suck it through a straw real fast and you'll hallucinate." You know what I mean? That stuff. So, of course, you go running for straws immediately. You know what I mean? So he got behind the dorm and he lit up the joint and he took a hit and I passed, you know, I did what he did and then the wine came around, I took a pull and we got it going, you know what I mean? And it happened. It happened. That thing that makes me bodily different from my fellows, that part happened. Because this warm feeling went down through my shoes and back up through me, man, and I knew in my heart of hearts. I'd never even thought this before. I was restless, irritable, and discontented from the get-go. And I remember thinking, "This is going to work out. This is going to be all right. I can do this." I mean, and I didn't really know what it was. You know what I mean? I didn't know if it was this pot. I didn't know if it was this wine. I didn't know if it was my two best friends I was hanging with now. You know, that I'd known for what, 15, 20 minutes? Man, see, these are my compadres, man. I didn't know, and I didn't care, man. I didn't care. Because you know what? I felt better than I'd ever felt in my life. The magic that happened to me was profound. It was phenomenal. And I paid no price for the magic. And that's real important for me to remember, that in the beginning, I paid no price. I didn't take a hit off that joint, and the siren started, and I went to jail. It didn't happen like that. It happened over a period of time. It was cunning, baffling, and powerful in my life. Powerful from the gate. Cunning from the gate. It was as if this disease had a consciousness of its own, it would have said, "Let's just play him real slow and easy. And when we get him out there, we'll give him the bad news." You know, that's what it did. So it was the humble beginnings. It was pot and wine. You know what I mean? And I just said, "I'm going to do this as often as I possibly can." And I did every day for the next 16 years, no matter what. Which brings me to my first opinion of the evening. Shocking, I know. An alcoholic with an opinion. And that's it. In my neck of the woods, I got this thing they tell newcomers. They tell them, just don't drink, no matter what. Just don't drink no matter what. Me personally, I hate that. I hate that. You're missing the point with me. Telling me just... I mean, if I could do that, if I could just not drink no matter what, there's absolutely no way I would be here tonight. Why would I come to San Francisco? Why would I drive up from L.A. today to San Francisco? And go through all of the emotional turmoil I go through getting up in front of a room full of people. Why would I put myself through that? Why would I sponsor 25 guys? Why would I work the steps? Right? Why would I get on an airplane? I'll explain why later, but I mean, no way. No way I'm getting on an airplane. No way. And I do it all the time. I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't have a sponsor. I wouldn't work steps. We wouldn't go anywhere near the four step. Ninth step? Yeah, right. Why would I do that? Because I'd just be home not drinking no matter what and having a nice life. Fact is, that misses the point completely with me. I am the flip side of that idea because I drink no matter what. I'm the exact opposite. It's the difference between me and the problem drinker. Given a good reason, the problem drinker stops. I don't. Never have. I never did. I never stopped for a good reason. I stopped as a result of a spiritual awakening. I didn't stop as a result of a good idea. Not powerful enough for somebody like me. Not powerful enough in the face of alcoholism and drug addiction. No way. I drink and use no matter what. Problem drinker gets another 502 and goes before the judge, and the judge says to the problem drinker, you know what? I'm sick of seeing you. I see you one more time, you're doing a year. A solid year, no conversation, not going to talk to you about it, you're doing a year. Don't come back in my courtroom again. Problem drinker says, well, I don't want to go to jail. Stops drinking and driving. Me, I start wondering what it's going to be like in jail. I'm going. I'm going to jail. And I know it. I mean, I accepted certain truths about who I am. It says in the book that at a certain point in a process of the steps that we swallow large chunks of truth about ourselves in 4 and 5, right? I swallowed large chunks of truth about myself out there. You know, that's the truth for me. Problem drinker's in a relationship with a great woman. Woman loves him. Woman says, I love you. Got a lot invested in this relationship, but your drinking's killing me. You don't stop for the drinking, I got to go. Problem drinker says, I love this woman. I got a lot invested. I got to stop drinking. I got to do what I got to do to keep this relationship afloat. Me, I start wondering what it's going to be like to be single because she doesn't get it. She doesn't understand. That's the way it always was with me. Because, I mean, I was clear of purpose out there. I drink and use no matter what. No matter what. You give me a good reason to stop, I just drink a little more. Blot out that good reason for stopping. I kind of know how to do it. That's what you do. It worked. So anyway, it was humble beginnings, pot and wine. 13 was pills, any kind of pills. First time I took a pill because somebody walked up to me and said, would you like a couple of pills? I said, well, yeah. You know, I took them, and a little while later, I was laying on the floor. I was comfortable with that. I was fine laying on the floor. You know, 14 with psychedelics. This girl said to me, would you like to drop some acid? I said, well, yeah. She pulled out I had gone on a 10-hour pass from the school, and I was hanging out with this girl, Debbie. I loved Debbie. Debbie was a bad girl. But she was. Debbie was a bad girl. I had such respect for Debbie, man. That was a whole new world to me. And Debbie was the older woman, man. She was 15 and a half. You know what I mean? This was really powerful stuff. And she said, you want to drop some acid? And I said, well, yeah. And she handed me a lipstick tube. You know, one of those little deals you spin the lipstick up out of? I don't know what you call them. And she's, thank you, lipstick. I got a wise. You're a wise ass. I like you. I like her. So spun up, there's this little tiny pill on the end of the thing, right? So I thought, all right, I took it and I put it in my mouth. She said, did you take that whole thing? And I said, well, yeah, you know, it was a little thing, and I thought it was like, I'm used to caps, you know? She said, that was 3 hits of white lightning. Oh, yeah, a little identification in the room, huh? Needless to say, the next 2 days changed the course of my life. To this day, it's difficult to go into a supermarket. We decided in the course of this that we were married and we were going to go shopping for the family, you know. You know, so we went in the store, you know, a couple of teenagers tripping out of their minds, you know. And we got the cart and we're going down the aisle and I'm looking at her and I'm going, do we have children? She says, yes. Well, we got to get these diapers in. You know. We're shopping for the family. And everybody's looking at us like, who are they, you know? We're shopping. So, and there's like little moments I remember. I don't remember a lot because, you know, I was blasting around the universe while in that market. And to this day, it's tough to go into markets. You ever been in a market and you see that abandoned shopping cart, you know? You have, haven't you? Right? I understand that guy, man. Sometimes you just have to leave and come back another day. You know what I mean? Awful lot of decisions to be made in the market. So anyway, so 15 was needles. I started shooting dope because a girl walked up to me and said, "Would you like me to stick this in your body?" And I said, "Well, yeah." So she slammed me with a little bit of that stuff, and as I did this, I went. And as I was going down, I just remember thinking, "Oh yeah, this will work real well." To me, it was just another color in the paint box. You know what I mean? It was just one more color in the paint box. It was just one more anti-Earl medication. That's all it was to me. Now, you got to understand something. I identify as an alcoholic. I talk about drugs. A lot of people object to that, but I want to explain myself. I understand why they object to it, and I don't have an objection with their objection. I don't. The reason I talk about drugs is I'm a child of the 60s, and it's my story. Some people, you know what I mean, it was their mean, nasty mother or their ugly wife or whatever that drove them to drinking, and drinking got them here. You know what I mean? Me, it was drugs led me to alcohol, and alcohol led me here. That's the way it happened for me. No, hang on. I'd say, you know, that's six of one, half dozen of another, the way I see it. But I got to tell you that the reason I was so focused on the drugs at the time, and that's why I talk about it in that part of my story, is because we were children of the 60s, and that's what we were focused on. We were breaking away from our parents. We were forming our own identity. We weren't going to drink ourselves to death like our drunken parents were doing. We were going to kill ourselves in a whole new way. You know what I mean? We were going to, you know, our drugs. But the fact of the matter is, and you got to understand that all the information that I have is in retrospect about my life. I never knew what I was doing when I was doing it, and I was just doing it. You know, it's in inventory work and looking back that I recognize something very, very clear to me. My drug of choice is, what do you got? That's been my drug of choice always. It never made any difference to me whatsoever. If I can get enough of it in my body, I can kill the fear. And that's all I'm there to do. That's all it was ever about for me, was kill the fear. Let me stand here, be comfortable standing here doing what I'm doing with the people I'm doing it with. That's all I ever wanted. And that's why I went to the lengths that I went to, was just to accomplish that one thing, kill the fear. And since fear is the last thing I'll feel, I mean, since I've been here tonight, I mean, I felt confusion, mild irritability, a little bit of depression, lust. You know, that stuff just flies through me. You know what I mean? I go, "Oh, look at that. She's very attractive. Look at that. Oh, no, oh, look at that. Oh, it's really great to see him. You know, look at that. That's great. And so who's that guy over there? That's nice." You know, there's a lot of emotions and feelings rolling through me. Way down at the bottom of the barrel, fear. That's the deep undercurrent that has always run my life. It doesn't anymore, but it always did. And that's what I'm drinking at. So I got to get drunk. It's the last thing I feel. I have to get drunk to kill the fear. That's what I'm there to do. So I have never been a social drinker. I got drunk in the beginning. I got drunk in the end. It's always the way it's been. And the reason I went, when I look back in my inventory work and I look at all the drugs that I was taking and all that, the drugs would come and go and come and go and come and go. But there was always one thing that was always on the table. Booze. There was always a bottle on the table. And the reason for that, in my opinion number two, is that drugs are unreliable. It's very simple. There's absolutely no quality assurance going on out there. You know what I'm saying? You never know really what you got. I mean, when was the last time you went to your heroin connection to buy some dope and the guy said, "You know what? We made a mistake. We stepped on it just a little bit too much this time. We really wouldn't want to sell you any of this low-grade stuff. Come back next week and we'll have a little better product for you." Never happened. Cocaine dealer the same way. LSD, you never know what you got. I mean, it's like spinning the chamber, man. It's Russian roulette. Throw it in your mouth, see what happens. That's how you find out what you got. Not true with Jack Daniels, is it? Not true with a fifth of gin. You get a fifth of gin, you know what you got every time. Because it's the same every time. And, you know, you got some, the cocaine's a little too good tonight. You can't get your mouth open anymore. You know? You kind of overshot the mark, you know? You suck a little gin through your teeth, you go back to party. You're all right. Acid a little too spooky? Jack Daniels will get you back in the comfort zone. He'll ease back off the throttle. You'll be all right. Not enough heroin to get you through the night, right? A little Tanqueray will get you the rest of the way. It'll get you where you need to get. There it is. I mean, that's the truth of it for me, is that booze is reliable. Drugs were not, you know? Unless, of course, you have plentiful prescription pads or things like that. I did not. So anyway, that's why I mentioned drugs. They led me to alcohol. I mean, alcohol was my best friend from the beginning. And the last 4.5 years of my using, it was about drinking. I drank anywhere from a quart to 2 quarts a day, and I'd use about 3-4 grams of cocaine to keep me on my feet so that I could drink the way I wanted to drink. And when I'd get so sick, I couldn't do that anymore. I'd eat about 150 milligrams of Valium just to get well enough to go back to drinking. It was never about sober enough for me, ever. So anyway, I did all that stuff. By 15, I was shooting dope. 16, I hit the nut house for the first time. I dropped out of high school. I figured 4.5 years of Latin was enough. My father stepped back in my life, said, "You're nuts," threw me in the nut house. They put me in for 3 months of observation and a year of rehabilitation. And what I was just a little drug addict alcoholic. That's what I was, who didn't want to be in boarding school anymore. You know, I wanted to get out in the world and check it out. Man, I'd been reading while I'd been in that place. Me and Jack Kerouac, you know what I mean? I was going on the road. I had to get out there and see stuff, you know? So where do I end up? The nut house. And I tried to escape. I mean, at this point, my tools for living are drugs, alcohol, violence, and run. Those are my tools for living. I have my tools for living. I know that I can now go out in the world and be successful with these tools. I'm in the nut house, and I decided that I needed to escape. I mean, it makes sense. They lock you up. You try to get out. And they've been shuffling around in there for weeks. And I was sitting having lunch. I had lunch every day with this woman named Kilday. Every day I had lunch with Kilday, because Kilday was a really insane person. Kilday really needed to be in this joint. And she was fun. I mean, every meal was like dinner and a show when you went with Kilday. You know? Kilday was going crazy all the time. And she was fun, you know, it was peppy, you know, everybody's like shuffling around in the nut house, you know. Achilles all there, you know. She was a trip. We were talking about my escape at lunch, and I decided, this is it, I'm going to bust out of here. And they had the exit signs, those green exit signs, and I was going to bust out. And I was sitting there, and I remember thinking, ready, 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 go! And I was hauling ass, you know what I mean? That was as fast as I could go. But when you're in the nut house and you're just, you know, you're shuffling around there with everybody else, you don't know that you only got 2 speeds now, you know? Seated and slow. That's all you got. And I got the arms working and everything, man, and I can't get out. I can't. Oh, man. And I'm going, you hear over the loudspeaker from the nurse's station, you hear, Ed, when you got a second, you want to grab Earl? He's making a break for the door. Ed's over there having a sandwich going, yeah, I'll get him in a minute, you know. And I'm over there working for the door, you know. Tools for living. If you're going to live my life, you got to know. If you want to escape from the nut house, you got to get out before they get the Thorazine in you. Because if you don't, you leave when they say. Simple as that. So, the next time they threw me in the nut house, I escaped the first day. I did my little stay in there, and I got out and hit the streets for a while, and it got crazy again, and they threw me back in the nut house. I remember sitting there thinking, you know, geez, I'm really glad you caught me. It was really tough out there. I was really having a bad time. Hey, look at that. And I'm hauling ass out the back. I'm in the backyard of this place. It was in West L.A. It was called the Westwood. It's a big hospital now. And I've since done business with the administrator of that place. That hospital, I'm sitting having a business meeting with this guy, and he kept saying, you know, your name is really familiar. I kept saying, yeah, well, it's a common name, you know. Can we move on here, please? Eventually, at the end of the thing, I had to tell him. I said, you know, I escaped from here about 16 years ago. And he just kind of looked at me for a second, and he says, well, it's good to see you doing so well, Earl. He was really cool about it. But as I was hauling ass across that lawn for that fence, all right, I mean, I got an intern right on my tail, and the truth of my life is that I'm an alcoholic. I'm a drug addict. I'm a high school dropout. I'm at any moment, hopefully, an escape mental patient. That's my resume. That's what I have to say for myself, you know? And I'm thinking, if I hit that fence, I don't have any problems. If I make that fence, I don't have any problems, because I'll be loaded in 20 minutes. And that's all that matters, because I drink and use no matter what. No matter what. It doesn't matter what happens. That's what works for me. Nothing makes me feel better in the world. Nothing else makes it possible for me to be in a conversation with another human being. I need it. It's mine. I got to have it. And everything else is just a lot of conversation as far as I'm concerned. I hit the streets. I do what you do out on the streets. I ended up... War story, blah, blah, blah. Another war story, blah, blah, blah. Another war story. All right? Now I'm about 20. And I end up getting, I get diagnosed to have malignant cancer, and they tell me that I'm going to die. And that they tell my family that I'm going to die. I'm not hanging out with my family anyway, but you know, you got to go say, well, bummer, Mom, I'm dying, you know. So they bring me back to LA. They do major surgery on me, on my upper back, right? I start to do the nuclear medicine routine, and I decide, I hate this. These are awful drugs. So I just said, screw you, I'm not doing this anymore. And I stopped, and I went back to my house, and I got loaded the way I know how to get loaded, right? And I beat the cancer thing. And I'm thoroughly convinced at this point in my life that basically the reason I beat the cancer thing is because I was getting so loaded, and my body was so toxic at that point, the cancer could not live in my body. The host was in worse shape than the disease, so the disease just left. So, I quit. I beat that thing. And I was up here going to school. I decided I needed to go to school. I mean, who knows where that came from. And I went on an interview to a college up here. And I got accepted on the interview. I didn't even have a high school diploma, you know what I mean? So one more time, I got to figure out how to work this out. So I go back to my father and I said, look, I got accepted to college. Don't ask. If you write me a check, I'll leave town. He said, beautiful. Cut the check. I came up here. Me and this woman piled in this van with 8 pounds of hash and came up here to Higher Learning. You know what I mean? And I laid a year's tuition on them and told them the transcripts would be in the mail. They said, no problem. We'll work that out. Went down and did a adult night school, high school thing in East Palo Alto High. Lovely place. Yeah, I was there for the riots and stuff. It was lovely. And was going to college and living with this woman, and I became a drug dealer. I got serious about my drug dealing. And I was studying marketing and production and distribution, and I was applying into my business. And business was booming. I thought college was cool. This is working out. And I was getting loaded a lot. And my mother calls me and says, I was really getting nuts. My mother calls me and says, we haven't been anywhere as a family in 10 years. Crying, we'll go anywhere you want to go, let's just go as a family. And I said, fine. I flew back to L.A., and on my 22nd birthday, we got in a plane to fly to Guadalajara, and on the way there, the plane crashed. And my mother, my father, my little sister were all killed, and I wasn't. And I woke up on this mountain in Mexico, and my skull was fractured, my back was broken in 3 places, my leg was... everything was broken. I had a lot of internal injuries. I was paralyzed from the waist down, and I was awake. The only thing I could move was my right arm. And I just lay there, and I watched them all bleed to death. And I quit the game right there. I mean, up to that point in my life, everything that I was doing out in the world was really there as a facade so that you'd leave me alone and I could drink the way I wanted to drink. I would use my cancer as, you know, hey, I got cancer. I'm under a lot of pressure. You drink this way, too. I'd say whatever I needed to say to you to get you away from me so that you wouldn't cut me off so that I could keep drinking the way I needed to. And I also understand in retrospect that when they sent me away to that school when I was 12 years old, I worshipped my father. He was a mean, ornery son of a bitch, and I loved him. You know, that doesn't always have to make sense. That's the way it was. And when I thought I'd been thrown away when I was 12, I spent the next 10 years of my life trying to become something that I thought he'd have to respect and he'd take me back. I was real plugged into him. And he was an attorney, and I had just gotten an early acceptance to go to USC Law School when I was up in this college. and I was going to become an attorney, so we would be equals. I had no interest in the law. I had an interest in hooking back up with my father. And when I watched him die, and I watched my little sister, my mother die, who was just a beautiful, sensitive, loving woman. I mean, she and I were real clean. There wasn't a lot of inventory work there. She was just, I was very, very lucky that the primary women in my life, my little sister and my mother, were just beautiful human beings, and they loved me unconditionally, and I knew it, and it was just, I quit. I had no interest in a God that would take people like that and leave a lying, cheating, dope fiend like me on the planet. I had no interest in a God that would do that. And while I was up on the crash site, some guys came up and scavenged the wreck and took the money out of my wallet and left me up there to die. So I had no interest in human beings anymore either. So I took God and human beings off my list. What I was a hellacious, hope-to-die, dope-fiend alcoholic, and I was going to get my ass off this mountain and show you just how angry I was. And that's exactly what I did. They took me off the mountain. They took me to a Red Cross station. I tagged my right toe, my big toe, and they waited for me to die because I was a mess. And I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't die. And they took me to a hospital, and they plastered me from the neck down and shipped me back up to the States like a package. And they put me in a hospital, and I stayed there a long time. They told me I'd be blind in my left eye, I'd have a withered left hand, and I probably wouldn't walk again. And I walked out of there with a custom-made brace on my back and a cane and worked my arm hand real, and I see fine out of my eye. I mean, I came out. I worked real hard to put it back together. Yeah, well, anger was my motivation. That's what motivated me. I mean, it would be nice to say, you know, I was just a real strong, tough kid. That's bullshit, man. I was pissed off. That's what motivated me to get back on my feet, because I was going to go out there and show you some real using. And it's funny that the next 4.5 years of my life, I got a lot of money out of the airplane crash. I got I had a house in Bel Air and a couple of houses in Palm Springs and a yacht in the marina and a bunch of cars and a whole lot of cash. I mean, I was sitting pretty. And I went for it. I went for it. I threw a party, and 4.5 years later, I was almost dead. My last run was 4.5 years long, and I've been stabbed a couple of times. I've been shot at. I've come to in real strange places. Lots more war stories. Lots of real insanity. I was drinking myself to death. That was the point. I wasn't trying to fake it anymore. I didn't have any reason to fake it anymore. What I am is an alcoholic, and I drink. If you don't like it, get out of the way. I was real clear of purpose. If you had drugs, alcohol, sex, or information on how to get me some or all of the above, I would talk to you. If you didn't, next. It's real simple, because that's all I'm about. That's all I'm about. I don't know about friendship. I don't know about loving and being loved. I don't do any of that stuff. I'm not interested in who you are as a human being. I don't care. I don't care. I'm a heartless, lying, thieving, angry, wounded animal. And I'm going to show y'all that my anger is righteous, and I'm going to do whatever I want to do, whenever I want to do it, until I drop. And that's what I did. And that's what it was like for that 4.5 years, and it got nuts. And what happened to me was that I burned it all to the ground, and I came out of my last blackout, and I was yellow. I had been told by two doctors independent of one another, if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. This year, and it was like the fall already, you know what I mean? It's like you're running out of time. I was 28 years old, and it was horrific, the shape I was in. I had hair out like this and a beard out like this. I was yellow. I weighed 215 pounds. I had over 700 stitches in my body. I had broken about 75 bones. And I was, the doctor said, too many direct hits, man. You just beat it to death. And that's what's happening. You're going to die. And I just remember looking at him and saying, okay. You know? But I came out of that last blackout, and I got a lot of 4-day blackouts that I don't remember. For some reason, 4 days is my amount of time. I can get 4 days, wake up, have no idea what happened. I'll lose 4 days forever. And both my hands were broken, and I was sitting there, and I didn't want to die. It had changed. I didn't want to die. And I put my hands up, and I said, help. They took me by ambulance to an emergency room. They pumped my stomach. They said, get him out of here. He's dying. And they took me to an alcoholism unit over in San Fernando Valley. And they kept me for 5 days, and they said, he's getting worse. Get him out of here. And they took me down to Long Beach General Hospital under the care of a lady by the name of Dr. Vicky Fox. And she got a hold of me, and they detoxed me for another 12 days. And then I kept me on a free bed for another 30 days, and when I left, I knew one thing. If I drink, I'm a dead man. Thyroid wasn't working. Kidneys weren't working. Liver wasn't working. You know what I mean? Nothing was working. I was just barely... physically, I was barely alive. Emotionally, I was gone. I hadn't dealt in a human fashion with another human being in so long. It was ridiculous. And through a series of circumstances, I ended up sitting in the back of a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I came here, I got here a great way. I got here destroyed. I came here hopeless. That isn't an opinion. That's a fact. I was hopeless. I had no hope. I had no tools for living that worked anymore. My family was dead. I had no friends. I had no place to live. I had no money left. I had a 1968 Volkswagen that nobody else in their right mind would get into. I had a box of clothes, and I was completely out of my mind. And all I wanted to do was I wanted to sit in the back of an AA meeting and find out if you could show me how I didn't have to go back into the madness, because I couldn't take the madness anymore. And I didn't want what you had. I didn't know what you had. This hadn't crossed my path. But I heard that this is where people came who drank like I did and didn't want to do that anymore. So I sat in the back with all my best thinking intact. My best thinking did not get me here. My best thinking almost kept me from ever getting here at all. And I sat in the back with my arms folded, waiting to find the differences between you and me so I could leave and go die. Just wait. So I thought. And the guy, first speaker, the main speaker got up for the meeting. I mean, every meeting's got... Oh, it was awful. I mean, the guys, the old timers, the guys in the room with time saw me, and they gave me a lot of room. They did not come over and shake my hand. This is what I looked like. They didn't come over and shake my hand, say, "Hi, how you doing? My name's so and so. You know, can I get you a cup of coffee?" They saw me come in and they said, "Coffee's right over there, man. Go right over there. Don't come near me, brother. Go right over there." You know, because they were smart, because they could read the signals. They'd been sober a while. This is a guy that needs some room. But every meeting's got a guy with 7, 8, 9 months who's just caught fire with this AA thing, and he's going to give it away now. And they had theirs, you know what I mean? And he saw me, and his face lit up, man, and he came across that room with his hand out and a big smile on his face. Oh, Jesus. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, great. Look at this. Look at this smiling fool. I hated that. I mean, he smiled, and he came up to me, and he said, "Hi, my name's Vegas. I'm an alcoholic." Some of you know Vegas, I'll bet, huh? He said, "My name's Vegas, I'm an alcoholic." And I said, "So what?" You know, yeah, me too, you know, and it ain't exactly the highlight of my life. I don't know what you're so thrilled about. Get away from me. And he looked at me with those knowing eyes that we get. I still react poorly to this. He said, those knowing eyes, and he looked at me and he said, "You keep coming back." And walked away like he'd laid a big one on me, you know? And I'm sitting there thinking, what the hell is he talking about, you know? It was obvious there's some big, deep spiritual meaning of that, and I don't know what it is. I'm a loser, you know? They probably all know what that means, and I don't know what it means. I'm a loser. They're not. One more time, I shouldn't be in this place. This is ridiculous. Luckily for me, I had nowhere else to go. If you're new, and people do that to you, people come up to you and they go, "Just keep coming back." And walk away like, "Yeah, man, look at that, man. I helped that guy," you know? You know, or they give you that, or they give you the big one, the beauty. "Hey, just turn it over, all right?" You know? They do that to you. Do yourself a favor. Say, "Excuse me, but I don't really understand the deep spiritual significance of that. Would you mind explaining it to me?" About 80% of them are going to go, "Well, geez, I'd love to, you know, but I can't. I don't really know. I guess this guy said it to me, and I'm saying it to you, and I don't have any idea what it means." You know? You know? Why don't we go ask that guy over there? Maybe he knows what the hell's going on, you know? And I can say that because I did a lot of that myself. Guilty of that. But then, I mean, all that stuff was going along, and I was just grabbing this stuff and putting it in my pocket. I have no idea what this means. I'll hold it for later, you know what I mean? And this old guy got up, and he was 65 years old, and he was a Skid Row bum, and he was a wino, and he was an ex-boxer. And I just thought, that's it, you know? I'm none of those things. I only drank wine if there was nothing else to drink, you know? I'm not a boxer. I like to be armed, you know? I'm not... Much too small to be a boxer. You got to get armed out there. You know what I mean? Skid Row, was never on Skid Row. I couldn't find Skid Row. You know what I mean? And I'll tell you something else. I mean, Skid Row is a warm place in my heart for Skid Row. You know why? Because you know what you do there? You go to get yourself a short dog, you go sit in a doorway, and you drink it. And nobody comes up and says, "Hey, what are you doing?" "I'm drinking. I'm on Skid Row. I'm an alcoholic. I'm drinking. Go." Nobody bothers you. They see a guy drinking a short dog in a doorway in Skid Row, they go, "Skid Row." That's very comforting to somebody like me. Anyway, so I'm sitting in the back, and he gets up, and he does his thing. And I noticed the differences between me and you. And I mean, this guy got up, and instantly I had differences, and I knew this guy didn't understand me. Because I had picked up the differences immediately. I mean, if you're a woman, you don't understand me. If you're 5 years older or 5 years younger, you come up in another time, you don't understand me. If you're gay, you don't understand me. If you're black, you don't understand me. And on and on and on and on. You guys don't understand me. I mean, by the time I got here, I got the wagon circled so tight, it was like, if you're not Earl, you don't understand me. It's different. You know, I was dying of that terminal uniqueness, you know what I mean? But the beauty of the way I got here was, as I got in the back, knew that guy didn't understand me, but I had burned my life to the ground. I had no place else to go. I had nowhere to go, so I had to sit there. I had nowhere to go. Nobody to talk to, nothing to do, no place to live, no job, nothing, nothing, nothing. There was nowhere to go. No physical spot to go get in the car, jump start it, and go there. There was no there. There was just right here. So I sat there, and that guy changed my life. God talked to that guy that night. He said two things. One thing, he shared openly and honestly about his feelings as a man, and I'd never heard anybody do that before. I'd never heard a guy do that before. And I got to sit back there looking like I was annoyed with the whole thing, and inside being really impressed with it. Really impressed with it. And then the second thing he said, "And I don't care whether you like what I got to say or not. Don't like it, go to another meeting." I loved that. Because it was real clear to me, you know, this guy's not selling me something. He's sharing it with me. Big difference to me. He's sharing it with me. If I want it, it's mine. I can have it for free. If I don't want it, that's okay too. No hard feelings. Go to another meeting. Maybe there's somebody over there that'll give you something you can identify with. And I thought, this is beautiful. I'm coming back. And I've been coming back for 13 years and 10 months because of that, what that guy said that night. You applied to yourselves. I didn't get 13 years and 10 months. You did. You know, you handed all of that to me. All of the stuff that I use that holds me in good stead today, I came in here with none of it. Got it all here. I got it all here. 100% of it I got here. Had none of it. I had no tools for living when I got here. None. None that worked. None that I could use anymore. It had them beaten out of me. So I started going to meetings, and they said, more meetings, and more meetings, and more meetings. And then they said, get a sponsor. And I said, what's a sponsor? And they said, somebody who's got what you want. I thought, oh, great, you know, another AA trick question. What the hell? Okay, what do I want? I think it's a very bad idea this early in the game to be throwing the ball back in my court. You know what I mean? You decide. And I couldn't figure it out. And I have since come to believe something entirely different. I don't think I want a sponsor who's got what I want. I want a sponsor who's got what he wants. That's what I want. And I have one. So I started doing all the AA stuff that they say to do around here. You know what I mean? I was doing it all. By the time I was 3.5 years sober, I was actually a human being. I'm one of the slow ones. But I never took a chip. I never spoke. I never opened my mouth in an AA meeting. I didn't take a cake until I was 3 years sober. And that was only at the insistence of my sponsor. And the first time I opened my mouth in a meeting, I was 2.5. And I did it because my sponsor told me if I didn't, I was going to drink. So I did it. I was a slow one in here. I told him I'd never ever share from a podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd sat in the back of meetings and listened to them these judgmental sons of bitches. I wasn't getting up there because I'm not going to have them judge me and throw me away. I got nowhere else to go. He said, that's a lovely sentiment. You're the first speaker here next Saturday night. That's how that happened. I walked right into it. Every time I drew a line in the sand, he knew it was time for me to step over it. Because you got to be willing to go to any lengths if you want to stay here. And that's been true for me. And that's all I can share is my experience. Anyway, I got to 6.5 and I got a little squirrely. And I went up to an old timer and I said, hey, 7 to 9 meetings a week, taking out 2 panels, never turning down an AA request, got the commitments, call my sponsor on a daily basis, sponsoring guys. I mean, you know, I got it all. How come I'm nuts? He said, Earl. He was a tender guy. He said, Earl, I saw you come in, and if you don't get a program, you're probably going to die. Go away. He said, excuse me, and I gave him the litany of stuff I was doing. He goes, Earl, that's the fellowship. Lovely stuff, vital to your recovery. Glad you got it. Glad you got it. It's lovely stuff. But what you need is a program. The program you'll find in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I suggest you get one and read it like your life depends on it, because we saw you come in and it clearly does. Go away. All right. So I went and I got a book. And my buddy said, my buddy had eight years. I had 6.5 years. He said, all right, we're new. Screw this time thing. We got together. And we got together with a book. Who knew? This book thing. Yeah? It's the best kept secret in AA. I mean, the book. It was this great book. I had no idea. I'm 6.5 years sober, and I'm going, have you read this? This is outstanding. I mean, stuff is clicking in my head, and stuff is going together, and I'm thinking, well, there it is, right there. Right? Turn water over. You're willing your life. It says it right here. I understand now. You know, that thing comes out of the pocket and goes up on the table. Okay, good, good, good. And basically what I found out was that symbol, that circle with a triangle in it, is an ancient spiritual symbol. It stands for mind, body, and spirit brought together as a whole human being. And that was the balance I was seeking in my life and had never had, drunk or sober. Never known balance. I was maniacal. I'm either on 0 or 100 all the time. You know, victim, assassin. Victim, assassin. My whole life, you know what I mean? I never been down in the middle. I never felt just kind of angry, you know? I either felt victimized or went into a homicidal rage. I didn't know about down the middle. I had no balance. I had no serenity. I had no peace. I was 6.5 years sober, and the promises were not coming true for me. They were not. I was unaware of them. I was unaware of them. So AA adopted this symbol, and it's Unity Recovery and Service. It's the same thing. Unity is the body. I bring it here. Mind, body, and spirit. The unity is the body. I bring it here. I sit down, I shut up, and I listen like the old timer said to do, and that's what they told me to do, and that's what worked. That works. You can object to that all you like. You can make a list of all the things that you don't like about that, and at the bottom you have to put, and it works. And you avail yourself of all the opportunities in meetings that allow you to manifest certain spiritual principles that are afoot here, like making the coffee. Like doing the signing. Doing the things around here that allow you to be of service to others. Because I am a self-centered, frightened individual. I never thought of another human being my whole life. And to be given an opportunity to make the coffee is not just I get the lousy job because I'm the new guy. Uh-uh. I get the best game. They give the new guy the best deal. You get to make the coffee. You get to have 4 hours tonight where you're worrying about all of that stuff. And you get to get out of self and be of service to us. So when you get back to you, you'll have a whole new perspective. And everything grows and expands and enlarges. And everything looks better and brighter. And you move forward with your life. You expand. You ascend in this process. Now, they could have said that to me and I would have gone, what? So my sponsor said, make the coffee or drink. I understand this. One more time. You can't talk to these people with time. They have no interest in it as Earl sees it. You know what I mean? None at all. You just start to explain to them this great idea you got in their head and they say, shut up, do it or drink. Well, you know, one more time, they've cut to the chase. There's nothing else to say. You know, make the damn coffee. So, I mean, I was doing all this stuff, you know. So the unity was the body. Bring it here. Do all that. Recoveries of the mind. That's what the 12 steps are about. They're in the big book. The 12 and 12 talks a lot about them. Great book. Great information. Great stuff. But if you want to know how to do them, the big book tells you how to do them. So you go to the big book. And the recoveries of the mind. The greater aspect of my disease. I mean, if it was just about, see, this ain't about stopping for me. It's about not starting again. I stopped a whole bunch of times. 2-3 times a day, stop. The trick is not starting again. That's always been the big trick. And if it was just, there's a guy in the program talks about, if it was just about the physical aspect of the disease, detox centers would be kicking out winners. 72 hours and free. You'd be free. You don't have to worry about it anymore. But that's not the case. I have this obsession of the mind. So the persistence of this illusion, this belief in a lie that I can drink like the normal individual is astonishing. Many of us pursue it to the gates of insanity or death. I've done both. It's about not going back and picking up that drink and activating the physical phenomenon of craving, and there I go, I lose the power to choose, and I'm back out in the game again. Back out in the madness. Don't want to do that. Got to deal with the obsession of the mind. How? Work the 12 steps. The whole point of them. The whole point of the steps. Step one is, what's the problem? Lack of power is my dilemma. I'm powerless. Whole life's unmanageable as a result of this one thing. That's my problem. What's my solution? Step two. That a power could restore me to sanity, soundness of mind, relieve me of the obsession to drink. Biggest promise in the book, I think. Well, it says self-knowledge avails me nothing. What should I do? Well, you better make a decision to do something about it. This is a program of action. Do step three. Get down on my knees, say the third step prayer, turn what over? My will and my life to the care of God. Get back up, embark upon a plan of action to make that happen. 4 through 9. Do this inventory. Do this fourth column inventory in resentment, fear, and sex. And I got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 in black and white right in front of me. Right there. Do it. 10, 11, and 12 to keep me in the game. 10 is me, 11 is God, 12 is you. Nobody else to play with. 10, I got to keep my side of the street clean, and when I'm wrong, admit it. 11 is I got to seek through prayer and meditation. For what? To improve my conscious contact. The action's on me. I seek God through prayer and meditation. And it's, when they read that portion of chapter 5 in meetings, the last thing they say is, God could and would if you were sought. It doesn't say God could and would if you were found. It says if you were sought. That if I take this action, if I open myself up to this, if I take the action, it will come. So that's what I do, and I seek how? Through prayer and meditation. The book gives me lots of ways to do that. What do I pray for? Knowledge of His will for me and the power to carry that out. Because getting into anything else, I'm going to sell myself short. Done it plenty. The third side of the triangle is service. How do I get there? The 12th step. You. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of the steps. Having been restored to sanity, having had the obsession to drink removed, I can practice these principles and carry the message. Be of service. Begin relationships with other people with how can I help, as opposed to what do you got for me? A whole new way of being in the world. Whole new way. Powerful stuff. Powerful. So my buddy and I, we did all this, and as a result, my life has changed completely. Unity, recovery, and service. Try to do all three sides of the triangle every day. Try to be of service on a daily basis. Check out my steps on a daily basis. Be of service to other alcoholics in meetings on a daily basis. Go to meetings. Call my sponsor. Check in. Tell him how I'm doing and ask him how he's doing. So I do all that stuff. And I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. Absolutely beyond my wildest dreams. In this last year, a guy I sponsored with 6.5 years who was like one of the family was murdered. Had to be a pallbearer at his funeral. It was heartbreaking. The mother of my goddaughter was murdered. Had to go to her funeral. Got pneumonia this summer. Got real, real sick. Had never been real, real sick, sober before. Went through all kinds of changes around that. Recovered from that. But it took its toll on me. A good friend of mine had a heart attack and died. Boom. Another one. My wife was pregnant. I was excited. Week later, she had a miscarriage. Boom. Emotional up, emotional down. She and I agreed to separate. Realized it was the gentlest thing for us to do, but a very difficult, a great decision to get to, but a very, very difficult one to get to. Very, very difficult. Two members of the program coming to a decision like that. Tough. And then about 50 days ago, my sponsor, the only sponsor I've ever had, the guy who was Alcoholics Anonymous to me, the only individual I trusted on earth for the first 2.5 years of my recovery, had a heart attack and died. And it was the biggest hit. Everything else that I've said to you pales by comparison to that. That was the most profound emotional experience I have ever had in my life. I've never felt pain like that in my life. I was so lost. I had absolutely no idea what to do. And I could hear his voice talking to me. In his death, he prepared me even for that. And I heard, as I was sitting there waiting for them to come get the body, I heard him say to me, get a sponsor right now or you're never going to get one. So he'd been dead 3 hours and I had a new sponsor. Beautiful man. That I check in with. I call him up in the morning, I check in, I hang up, I cry, I go about my day. Because I don't want to call him. And he understands this, that I love and respect him and I'm very grateful to have him in my life. But I want Donald. I walk around a lot of the time wondering, how do I do this? There's something missing. What is it? What it is I need to talk to Donald and I can't. You know? And I, what I, This is the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, as far as I'm concerned. My perspective on all this. Sounds like it's been rough, but you got to really, really step back from it and look at it for what it is. The fact that Donald Madden dying broke my heart says I'm loving and being loved again. And that I loved somebody enough to feel the kind of pain I felt. That is a beautiful thing. The fact that my wife and I have agreed maturely as adults to separate is a beautiful thing. That we're doing this with respect for one another, you know, and thinking of the children, her kids, my stepdaughters, as opposed to ourselves. This is a beautiful thing. I mean, I've got problems in areas where I didn't even used to have areas. You know what I mean? So basically what I find now is I find myself standing here basically 41 years old, single again, moving again, business is great, blah, 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 blah. I have a great life. I have a great life. I'm doing all the things I can't do. I'm loving and being loved. I have the respect of my peers. I function effectively and honestly in the workplace. I'm doing all of the, I sponsor a lot of guys. I am sponsored. I remain humble before my sponsor. I do the things that I'm told to do in here. And as a result of all of this, inside me, I'm fine. There's all this stuff going on out here, but I'm okay. I feel centered. I'm feeling some peace and some serenity and some contentment. I said to a friend on the phone from my hotel room here, I said, isn't it interesting? With all this stuff going on, I get in a car, I drive all day by myself in the rain up to San Francisco, I lay down in my room by myself, I hang out for a little while, and I don't feel lonely. I don't feel that loneliness. I'm okay. I'm fine. That's remarkable. As far as I'm concerned. If you're new and you think I'm nuts, you're wrong. I used to pride myself on being the insane one. And there's a woman in the program who talks, I remember I was sitting one day, the first time I'd ever heard her talk, she said that when she was out there using it, was like the first time she went up to this party up in the hills, and there was a guy there, it was the first time she'd ever seen a guy using in a way that she thought, this guy's going to drop dead right in front of me, and it scared her to death. And she said, and that's him sitting right over there. It was me. I was that guy. I don't have those kind of problems anymore. I'm not crazy like that anymore. I'm sane. I'm a rational human being. I'm participating fully in my life. I'm having a blast. I really am having a blast. I get to travel. I get to come and go as I please. I get to do whatever I want, when I want. It's a great life. And it was given to me by Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no tools for living, and I was a wounded animal when I came here. And that's changed 100% as a result of being here with you. So if you're new and you're wondering about this deal, that's my experience with it. If you're sitting here and you're nuts, fine. If you're thinking, I don't understand any of this, I don't like these people, this makes no sense to me whatsoever, I would rather be anyplace else on the face of the earth, I hate this, perfect. That's fine. You can do all of that here. You can have all the room you need to do that here. But if you just have any humility at all, any willingness to learn at all, if there's any crack in the armor at all, pay attention to that and watch what happens around here. It's just way past just not drinking and using. This goes way past this. This is a design for living. And we insist on having fun, and we do. These all look like very stable, normal individuals. Not a chance. I mean, the rest of the world run, they get out there partying and getting a little crazy. They run right out to the end, up to the cliff, and they stop. And they, the cliff. And they, they take a step back. What we do is we run right out to the cliff. We don't slow down, man. We just leap. And we end up in jails, institutions, graveyards, and here. These are very interesting people. Get to know them. They're a lot of fun. I guess what I want to say is that I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what I am. I'm a grateful member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have a life as a result of being with you. Thanks.